Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 49.
For Tina and you, that's Swedish.
Hey, Lindsay.
Hey. Oh, hi, Josh. I didn't notice you there.
So we saw a few shows this past 2 weeks.
Yes. Yeah, we did.
And we saw, you know, when you see a show and it's like you see one of these kinds of things every 5 or 10 years where it really blows your mind. For me, I think that was like the first time I saw Cirque du Soleil or the first time I saw James Thierry. I had one of those moments again this past Saturday.
Yeah, I think I was right there with you on having that feeling.
I was going to say you were right there sitting next to me.
I was right there literally sitting next to you, but I was right there. Like, I haven't seen something in a while that made me feel like so emotional that like I didn't know why I wanted to cry, but I just wanted to cry.
We went to the New York City Ballet to see a new piece by choreographer Justin Peck, who's 29 years old. He's the resident choreographer at the New York City Ballet. I think this was his fourth or fifth ballet, but it was called The Times Are Racing with music by Dan Deacon, who's an electronic artist. And I think this album was called America, maybe from 2011. It's the last 4 tracks on the album. It's about a 40-minute show. And it was amazing. Like, the ballerinas didn't wear point. They all wore regular shoes, and they were costumed like people now, I think.
Well, it's the creative directors of the clothing brand Kenzo.
Kenzo, okay.
Did that.
Is that like a high fashion label?
Yeah, it's like really cool stuff. I can't explain. It's a lot of like geometric kind of shapes, and their brand like logo is like a lion or a tiger.
Okay. I mean, the costumes were beautiful. They were bright colors, interesting fabrics, really shed the lines. But it was just something I'd really never seen before. It definitely made me think of Keone and Mari's group stuff when they did their like large West Coast urban hip hop dance groups. But run to go see the show. I don't know how many more times it's playing this year. I don't know. You know when you just sit there and you're just, your mind is being blown and you have this insane feeling of like awe and just chemicals, you know, running through your whole
body.
But
you know what's so interesting? So like what Justin mentioned is this piece is only about 40 minutes and it's a part of a larger, it was part of a larger set of 4 pieces that we saw. And the first 2 were choreographed by Christopher Wheeldon, who also choreographed American in Paris on Broadway, as other things. But those 2 pieces felt very like classical ballet in a weird way.
I mean, they were from the early 2000s, and the pas de deux. And the girl in that was amazing. But yeah, I agree. They just felt like really good ballet, but the kind of ballet you expect to go see.
Yeah, and then those 2 pieces. And then the piece right before Justin Peck's piece was like a little bit more contemporary with the costuming, but it still felt like a really traditional ballet piece. And it was interesting for me watching the people around us because we were one of the younger people there and they loved those pieces. And I loved them. I could very much appreciate it. But then when it was Justin Peck's piece, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And the woman next to me, who was maybe probably in her 70s or 80s, was like holding her ears closed. And I think like the generational like change of ballet and what you see in ballet, it was so evident there because you could see who was standing up for each piece. And just like each generation was kind of attached to like a certain era of like what ballet is.
Yeah. But, you know, I think with ballet, often the storyline they try to make quite clear, or they'll write it in the program. Like the one right before Justin Peck's was a piece called Odessa about Jewish gangs, I think, in Russia in the late 1800s. And after you read that, you can see it on stage. You can see there's like sisters and a group of guys and a gang, and you sort of get more of a general story. While with Justin Peck's, it just felt contemporary and modern and about like things going on right now and the pace of the world and, you know, one's own place in it without really literally having any super clear storyline. And I don't know. It makes going and seeing dozens and dozens of terrible shows over the years worth it to see a show like that every once in a while.
Another show I saw this past week was In and of Itself, which is playing at the Darryl Roth Theater.
I wish I could have gone, but I was in Kansas City shooting a VR scene.
Yeah.
So tell me, how was it, Lindsay? What did you think?
You know, I think doing a one-man magic show is ambitious. I think like a one-man show of any kind is ambitious because you only have yourself. I think it was cleverly laid out, you know, and it had a narrative in a way. talking about his different stories from his life. It was basically like six different stories that consisted of six different tricks. And there were only six tricks, pretty much, the whole hour and 20 minutes. So I think it was slow, but there were some tricks I thought were just like really good. And
this was from the guy who made Nothing to Hide, right?
Yeah, it was like one of the two dudes who were in Nothing to Hide, which was that signature. It's written and performed by Derek Delgado and directed by Frank Oz. And I mean, it was really beautifully done. I think it was slow paced. But the audience around me was, I think I feel a little jaded. I don't know, after seeing a lot of amazing magicians. And so there were times where I was like looking
For more.
But the audience felt really satisfied.
So my only experience being in the Dalla Roth Theater is seeing Forza Bruta, which is an all-standing show. How did they reconfigure the space for In and of Itself?
It's like bleachers. It kind of feels like when they did St. Anne's Warehouse for Let the Right One In. Bleacher seating seats about 150. They brought in curtains to make the space feel more enclosed, and the stage isn't that big, but they made it look really great.
Isn't this something to do with like cards on a wall? I've seen that in their ads, like with like I'm a this and I'm a that.
Yes, there's right when you walk in before you sit down, there's a whole wall of cards. It's cool because it looks really interesting, and it's all these cards that say I am a blank, I am a blank, like I'm an accountant, I am an artist, I'm a mermaid.
What did you pick?
I picked I am a juggler.
Oh.
But then I got nervous that he was going to make me like prove that I could juggle, which I can't. But they come into play later in the...
As a trick?
Yeah. It's like the final trick.
Okay. Yeah, don't give too much away.
It's worth going to see. It's cool. It's like an off-Broadway magic show. And it's doing well. And it'll probably be there for a while. So, interesting show to see.
Nice.
But didn't move me like Justin Peck's.
No, it's hard. I think hard to match something like that.
Yeah.
So this past weekend, we participated actually for the second time at the Future of Storytelling Festival. Last year, we had a slumber as part of a sort of a ticket promotion giveaway. Mm-hmm. I don't really know. We weren't in the festival. We were just affiliated with it. But this year, we were actually in the festival. And we did a performance with some of our favorite circus and dance artists from New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Went pretty well, I think.
Yeah, I think we were there nice and early yesterday to tech. We had Bo Parks Dance Company. Bo was a dancer in slumber. And then she just created her own dance collective called Shinsa.
She's an amazing choreographer in her own right. We actually didn't know that when we hired her.
Didn't.
We just hired her for being a dancer.
Yeah, and she's choreographing out here in New York, doing really cool stuff. So we had her dance group come and do two dances, you know, which was a great opener for us because they're so great. So then when we had to start talking, people already, I think, you know.
Buying into it.
Yeah. Like, who are these two weird people talking?
And then we had Olga Karmansky, a previous guest on the podcast, do her contortion number from Slumber. So nice to see that recapped again.
Yes. And for anyone who saw Slumber, and for those who didn't, Olga's costume consists of a white tank top that gets really bloody right before her number. And I didn't want to ask our special effects people to make me blood for this one thing. So luckily it is Halloween time and I was able to buy some fake blood at like Spirit Halloween.
Mm.
And I sprayed that puppy on and it got everywhere, but it looked good.
And then we also had Randy Cato, mm-hmm. who's a local New York serial artist and instructor, do his number. And we had Olivia Porter, who's going to be a future guest on the podcast, who's an Australian juggling sensation.
Yeah, I think the audience really, really liked the performances. They're beautiful to watch, as
always. Got like a mini version of our podcast. We talked about like some of the themes that, you know, you guys have heard us chat about two circuses in America and, you know, the differences between here and other countries.
Two circuses in America?
Yeah, like the idea that people who are in rural areas are seeing mostly tented shows and people who are in urban areas are seeing mostly contemporary shows in theaters.
Yeah.
And just hit some of those like big points that we've touched on. So,
yeah, it was really cool. It was in Staten Island, which I don't think I've been to since I was applying to colleges.
Yeah, it was at a Snug Harbor Music Hall, which you were telling me because you talked to the guy who runs it, that it has like some weird, interesting history.
Yeah, basically this guy who was like, I'm paraphrasing what this man told me, but he was besties with Alexander Hamilton and had a lot of money and then knew he was going to pass away and he was in his 40s wrote a will that said all of his fortune is left to this charitable trust that they want to build this basically retirement home for all these men in the, who served in the Navy. But because he died so quickly, the witnesses of the will actually signed it after he died. So then the will was in like was contested for 25 years in courts before they actually could build this. But they did build it. And now it's like a
historical
site where you host art exhibits and, you know, all this.
Sort of like Governor's Island with all the history on it, but in this case on Staten Island.
On this week's podcast, we have Amy Saunders, who is the star of Misbehave Game Show. She is Misbehave. So it seemed like a no-brainer to interview her since we work on her show. She is incredible. This interview is really, really interesting. Amy grew up in London, and she got into the club scene as a flyer when she was like 14, 15. And through that, she decided to start swallowing swords and taught herself. And it's a really crazy story how she learned how to sword swallow. And through that, kind of got into the Edinburgh Festival, Fringe Festival circuit, and then transitioned into cabaret variety shows and did La Clique and La Soiree, and has since toured all over the world with her own work. I think it's really rare that you talk to someone where you just are in awe of their creative genius, and maybe it's not something that you ever thought about, but that's what makes it so genius. You're like, wow, like what kind of brain is that that can create this world in her head of like this next project that she wants to work on? And that's how I felt the whole time talking to Amy. Inspiring.
Before we get into the episode and our interview with Amy, this is a content warning. There is a fair amount of swearing and talking about sexual acts, both on stage and off. I definitely would recommend that if you are a parent with young children to pause it here and listen to this later and make a decision based upon whether or not you want to share the rest of this interview with young kids. It is really funny and really interesting, but just touches on a lot of adult themes, and we use adult language quite a bit.
Yeah, so maybe if you're 16 and younger, skip this podcast and you can save it until you are 16.
Exactly.
On your 16th birthday, you can come back and listen to this podcast. If you like the podcast, make sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter tweet us, subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, or you can email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
We've also been getting a few questions of like, could you guys talk about this? Or like, what do you think about this? So feel free to shoot those over if there's like something on your mind in the circus world you want to get our two cents on.
Yeah, or we'll talk to people who know more about it, and then we'll relay that two cents to you.
Exactly.
But anyway, remember, if you're 16 and younger,
pause here.
Pause here. If you're a parent, pause here with kids listening. If you want to keep listening, you're in for a treat. Here's our interview with Amy Saunders.
Hey, Amy, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hi, guys.
Where are you originally from?
I am originally from the UK, Bristol, via, and then London. So, and actually via a Steiner hippie commune somewhere in the middle of that. So basically, a few years on a Steiner hippie commune, then Bristol in a, what do you call it, an experiment of a Steiner school that went wrong, and then moved to London and ended up. So moved from this sort of vibrant, incredibly multicultural, a wonderful city, and ended up in this sort of incredibly white, old Jewish suburb in London and lost my shit age 13. Spent about 2 months riling against my mum, and then discovered central London and went, ah, okay, here we go.
Were your parents working. Hippie artists? Is that why there was a hippie commune?
No, they were just both really into Steiner, like anthroposophy, which is, I mean, he's quite a groovy dude, actually. So my mum's a primary school teacher. She teaches little kids with special needs. And my dad is a, if you can believe this, an ethical banker, which basically means he understands numbers but doesn't give a fuck about money particularly, and so has made good things happen. Yeah, principles and success, what a bastard.
And a rare combination.
Yeah.
So totally. Were you seeing, once you were exposed to central London, were you seeing like loads of shows as a teenager and like, no, not at all?
I mean, this is the thing. I had no interest in being a performer. I found central London. I found nightclubs. I realized very quickly that I prefer being able to do something than just hang out. So I got myself a job, and that was flyering. And then I was a demon flyerer around the West End, so literally just trying to get people into clubs.
So we don't have the term in the States, flyering. Could you explain? Because we've heard in Australia too what flyering is as a job.
Like a street team. So
like a street team.
So back in the 90s, to get people into nightclubs, you'd get a few people out standing in Leicester Square giving out bits of paper saying, come to this club, essentially. And then I kind of worked for most of the clubs in the West End. I ended up working for the Marquee a lot, sort of the famed Marquee, which was great, but it was the end of its life, bless it.
And then worked pretty much every... You know what, Amy? Flyering probably helped you so much with, like, audience interaction.
My performance training, because this is the thing. So I then did everything. I did front of house, I did security, I did, what do you call it? Box, I guess. Front of house, security bar, and cloakroom. And through the people I was hanging out with and working with, I met quite a few performers. And my blanket opinion of performers was that they were all pretentious assholes, all of them, without exception, and I had absolutely no interest in it, right? and then I worked in clubs for a few years, and then I kind of burnt out. You know, just when you finish at 7 every night, morning, it kind of killed me. And I happened to see a flyer at my mum's house. She thought it would be good for my brother, and it was a free 2-year course, circus course, at Circus Space.
In London.
In London, and they were running it was like a vocational course. So it was for what you'd call it in the UK, thick people. It's called a BTEC. So it's like where you don't get any qualification. You kind of get a qualification to be able to make a draw or something. So I went to this course. I thought it'd be a great way to get fit. I found most of it crap. I mean, I'm a questioner, right? So, and they were just starting. And again, they were sort of in a sense well-meaning without infrastructure at this point. So I was a thorn in their side, and I spent most of the time reading sideshow books in the smoking room, because there was actually a smoking room at that point. And I basically, again, no interest in performing, was there purely to get fit, didn't really understand. You know, we had a fantastic clown teacher, and I still know him, Fraser Hooper. 15 years later, we chatted about it, and me just going, I just did not even understand what language you were talking, you know, and took years to understand it. So I then, I found a book called Memoirs of a Sword Swallower by Dan P. Mannix and read it and went, I want to be a sword swallower. Still with no relationship to performing, but I want to be able to sword swallow. How
old are you at this point?
I am 18 at this point.
What about the book where you like, I connect with that. I want to put a sword down my throat.
How X-rated is your podcast?
Well, you can tell the story, and then we can see if it's too X-rated.
Okay. Well, basically, I spent a lot of time with security guards in the West End, and security guards were populated pretty much by Jamaica and the West Indies, and I serviced a lot of security guards in the West End. And so when I read that, I thought, well, hang on a minute, this is just a skill set coming together, right? So I think this is made for me, and I was right. It was, you know, I've got most sword swallowers will put flourishes on their sword swallowing, you know, how long it took you and all the rest of it, and there's almost a code of ethics where, you know, don't say it was under 4 years, because for God's sake, everybody will try it.
Yeah.
Took me 6 months at home and I learned the worst way possible. Like, again, I was a clueless idiot with no idea of biology or, you know, any risk. I took instead of finding a sword or doing a drumstick or do some people do a bit of bread soaked in olive oil on the end of a bit of string, all of that shit. And I'd read Dan's P. Mannix's book, and he does sort of talk you through how you can do it. Nope. You know those shatterproof rulers you get?
Yep.
The see-through ones?
That have, like, sharp edges, almost.
So I took one of those. I then, with a lighter, I melted one of the ends down into a sort of semi-point. So then learning on is something that is wider, thicker, and infinitely more dangerous than anything else I've swallowed to date. But that's what I learned on. Thank fuck it didn't snap, or I would have just been dead. But it didn't snap.
Oh my God.
And I would literally just spend 5 minutes a day hacking on that.
You're giving me such anxiety just listening to the story. I'm like internally dying.
And then, but so then finally, and what I found is, I mean, you know, I'm sure you've sort of chatted to enough sword swallowers. There are certain lock points. And so basically I understand most of this in hindsight, but at a certain point I could just shove the whole ruler down my throat. We then had some segment of the course at Circus Space that required us to do an act. So, I was like, fine, I'll swallow this ruler then. So what I do is I have at this point, my plethora is this shatterproof ruler I've melted into a point that looks like a sword, and a knitting needle, a skinny one. Again, very dangerous to swallow because it can poke right through your esophagus. Medical staff teach students to treat the esophagus like a wet tissue. So a needle is not a great idea, Amy. And so my number was me swallowing a see-through ruler no one can see and an incredibly skinny needle that no one can see. My performance, oh my God. But, and I really struggled with the course. I was also, I mean, you know, my lifestyle outside of it was possibly not as circus as it could have been either. But kind of carried on in that way. And I think because, just trying to think, my timeline always gets confused. Somewhere just towards the end of it, I think. No, Thursday was busking. So basically I finished this course and I have no way to make a living or earn my rent or anything like that. And in London in the late 90s, you didn't need as much money to live. You didn't need as much money for rent. And if you needed to get around, you could walk because everything was more central. So it was, I mean, I guess like New York, you know, it was just manageable as a street rat. And I then asked three of the bars in the West End that I got on with and that I thought was reasonable to ask, if I came in on a Thursday and Friday, would they mind turning their music down for 5 minutes and I would stand on the bar with a pint glass in my hand, shout, and then swallow a sword and then pass the pint glass? And they did. And that's kind of how I earned my living for about 6 months. What else did I do? I also had a sign on a piece of paper that said, broke, all major credit cards gratefully accepted, which I thought was hilarious. And I would staple that to my forehead. I mean, these poor fuckers in the West End were like, what the hell is this? But it got me surviving.
When I first heard someone did a staple act, I was like, oh, like, how do you make it look like it's real? And they were like, no, you actually staple yourself.
But what? I had the opposite from a guy who, massive influence on me, a guy called Woody Bot Muddy, who had a late night act called Record Graveyard. So Woody Bot Muddy's Record Graveyard. And he used to come on stage with a record player and he'd play different tracks. He had loads and loads of gags, but he'd play different tracks. And if he saved it, it went to record heaven, which meant it was just got rubbed on a picture of some kittens. And if he nailed it, he had a golden hammer and he'd smash it. So, but we, the audience, decided, and he would also then throw out rice at the audience and just shout, rice, they love it in China. Staple diet of after. Fucking he was brilliant. And in a dressing room with him, this pretty early on, and I was doing my staples and my whatever, and he said, oh my God, do you actually do that? What? Wait, are you actually stapling at your forehead? I said, yeah, well, how else would you do it? And he went, oh, I don't know. Blue tack, gaffer tape, duct tape, I mean, any sweat, anything. What are you actually doing that? And again, that was the very first time it even occurred to me. You know, it's why I'm absolutely not a magician, is because the idea of, I feel like I really can sell shit to a shovel. Like, I'm definitely a salesman, but the idea of stepping on stage and going, hello, the premise here is that I'm going to willingly deceive you and you're going to buy it.
Right.
Do it. Can't do it. Like, my eyes get so shifty, it's just, you know. So it was always a real staple. And every now and then you'd hit a little vein or something and you'd get a squirt on.
Oh, my God.
But anyway, and my timeline gets a bit convoluted, and I don't know if you guys have found this, with when you've regurgitated stuff for press for so long, that actually in some ways you warp your own
life. Your story, history. Yeah.
Yeah, so basically around that time, several different things happened. I was working in fetish clubs doing, and again, the cabaret scene and where the performance and the interesting performance was very different. And so fetish clubs and sort of alternative cabarets and late nighty things and also nightclubs. I mean, there was a nightclub called the Funhouse, and a sort of sword swallowing to the YMCA kind of thing. But whatever, you know, it pays your bills. But I also got a call from Guinness World Records at that point saying, hey, we'd really like you to set the world record for most swords swallowed by a woman. And I said, oh, well, that record was set in the 1800s by Edith Clifford, and she swallowed 17 swords, and I can't do that, sorry. And they said, oh, yeah, no, we've got rid of some of the records. You've just negated your entire premise and reason for being.
Got rid of some of the records.
Yeah, you know, and so I was like, well, that's bullshit, but I'll take your money. And so I said, all right, I'll do five. And then I had to find somebody to make me five and all the rest of it. And then they ended up making me really terrible ones, but I'd been away and it was 2 days beforehand. And I get all of these swords and I realize I can't swallow these pieces of shit they've made. So I collect all the swords I've got made, which again have all been modeled on this goddamn ruler. Too wide, you know, and too wide and too, there was no need for them to be that long. I'd never tallied that it was about the length of your torso. You know, I'm an idiot. So I get five different shaped swords, slam them all together, fly it just so I know I've done it before I go on telly tomorrow kind of thing, prick my larynx, so I have an exceedingly swollen throat and think, fuck, you know, can I even do this? Go on the telly to do it, and it was live, and the presenter was a famous footballer, and we ended up having what I personally, you know, good live TV where you're just flirting wrong town on the improvisational side of things, and I'm like, well, this is fun. And then I do the swallow and I can't get it, like it's swollen, and I'm making all like kind of noises, live TV, that fake white TV, and I just know that I'm not gonna walk away without doing it, so I essentially just pushed.
Oh,
what an idiot. But I managed it. It was fine. You know, set the record that isn't really a record. And then proceeded with the Guinness sort of thread. I then got called back. I did it in, what is it, Spain, Italy, France, a few other countries.
For TV, for like live TV.
Yeah. And I would just repeat the format. So basically I'd go on and now, you know, no swollen throat, but I'd be like, oh yeah. You know, and then I slowly built it up from five to six to seven. And at that point, my plan was, and I kind of wanted to pull other female sword swallowers into it. We were like, you do eight this year, I'll do nine next year. You know, we can milk this puppy like it, because it doesn't mean anything. This is just mindless PR because Edith Clifford was the best female sword swallower. And then Natasha Varushka, New York lady, who I've actually never had the pleasure of meeting, but I've had the pleasure of emailing with, and my God, the girl likes a caps lock. she set a new record with 13 at, where was it? Like a sword, the sideshow convention on the Sword Swallowers Day or something in a badly lit, it really upset me. I was like, hey, just get that on telly at the very least, you know. And so now what I want to do is I would like to break Edith Clifford's world record for a suitable, you know, when I find a props maker for a suitable stunt to launch something. So, for example, here in Vegas, that's the perfect thing to do at some point to highlight something else via something else. But that's as interested as I am. You know, I've got so many of my sword swallower friends have just got such ridiculous records, like most swords swallowed underwater with sharks. And in fairness, I'm a sword swallower, so people can say why and it's reasonable, but I feel like my why to that is bigger.
Yes. You're like, but really?
I mean, and it's phenomenal. There's actually was one sword swallower. I saw him in finally saw him in Christchurch at the beginning of this year. And he does he's Ariel Manx, and he does a backflip with the sword inside him.
Oh.
Yeah. And I've seen it on video. Seeing it live was the first time I think that I got a reaction that some people get to seeing people who swallow swords.
Yeah.
Like really just, it affected me. It just affected me. It was amazing to see, again, in the why area, but I think with all of this, it's sort of why.
And why is to get that reaction?
Right. Well, yeah. Heather Holliday swallows like a light up sword.
The neon. Well, this is a thing. Yeah. I mean, and Heather, for the record, I think Heather is my favorite sword swallower, just because I find her clowning and her comedy so amazing with it. I think it's very hard. It's very rare to find a woman who is so hot being able to be funny in a way that isn't debasing her hotness.
Yes.
So it's just so good. And also the range of tricks. I mean, I remember seeing her do a sword swallow with Donnie, where then Donnie whips the sword out of her throat. And Jeez. So there's always a slight, and, you know, as a sword swallow, I'm going, doesn't that mean there's always a slight pull to one side? Either way, I mean, she's innovative with it as well. And yeah, I just think she's brilliant.
Did you recognize that you were sort of also doing comedy, like in your own identity at the same time? Or was that, were you really just, that was just part of the thing?
Well, no, at this point I wasn't. At this point I was literally an angry peroxide blonde teenager with a tattoo on her head. And so there was no, the personality was whatever the hell I am, because I still had no comprehension of performing. And around this time, so I'm sort of sword swallowing in wherever I can get. I'm being, and I think this is another lesson I learned, which I think a lot of New York performers have for sure, but where you just flexible yourself out. So you're like, oh, a dinner for old people. Yes, no problem. No, no, I can make that work. You know, so taking anything and everything and hustling. And then I went up to the Edinburgh Festival with my mum. We didn't actually know the festival was on. We were just going up for a couple of days to spend some time with some family friends. We walk into the Edinburgh Festival. We decide to see one show. I get to pick it. And it was the Kamikaze Freak Show. So we went to see that. And to date, the Kamikaze Freak Show is the most theatrical, brilliant theatrical freak show I had ever seen. It doesn't exist anymore. But the guy that put it together, John Kamikaze, who was the Prince of Pain, covered with question mark tattoos all over his body, looked amazing. His opening costume was 350 hypodermic needles in his body, you know, in his body. That was just took the cloak off, and that was just, that's how I do the show. He used to do the neon and skewers, and I mean, it was, but it was very well done theatrically without any narrative, just like the lighting states, the transitions, everything. It worked really well. And I left them a note just saying, oh my God, that was brilliant. You don't need me, but if you ever do, this is my number, you know, on these crappy little cards you get in the 90s. And they got in touch with me, and I ended up joining them. There was me, the Prince of Pain, then Power Tool, who was a dwarf who worked in circus and pantomime for years. And what Power Tool did was he...
That's such a good name for a performer.
It's amazing.
And his act, why he was called Power Tool, is he lifted heavy weights with his dick. And then he also... There was one point where we pulled an audience member out, put them in an office chair that was on wheels. I sat on them, and then he pulled them us around the stage with his dick.
Awesome.
But he was the first person to give me a proper performance lesson, which it still then took me about 6 more years to understand. So what he said to me, he said, listen, Amy, you've got a John, you know, the Prince of Pain needs his skewers for his cheeks, and you've got to get them to him. But the journey, that's yours, you know? And I sort of, you know, nodded, but had no idea what the hell he was talking about. And it was, again, there was a moment in hindsight where I finally went, I understand what he means now. And I actually think where I... So we went off to the Edinburgh Festival and did that, and we were sort of a really nice sleeper hit. It was a fun show to do, you know, maggot eating, whatever the hell I was doing in it. I used to have to clean the Prince of Pain's neon. So we did sort of the Edinburgh Festival. We also did a tour of Europe and sort of some student gigs and what have you. And he would he would eat like chicken curry. So he'd pull that freaking neon out. It was a double tube neon. I was like, why do I have to clean this? But during that Edinburgh Festival, I saw street performers in a way that I had not seen them framed in Covent Garden. So in Covent Garden, because I was a Leicester Square late night nightclub bitch, I would walk past there going, children's entertainers, who gives a shit? But by the time I got to Edinburgh, my brain was beginning to change about performance. And also I saw two clowns. One was a Cups and Balls guy called Nick Nicholas, and the other one was Pepe, who's a following clown. And both of them were so rude, sarcastic, angry, like fucked up. And I just went, I didn't know you could do that. Didn't know. And, you know, really watching the work. So one's a really small show and one's a big wide show. And I just went, okay, I want to be a street performer. And so from there, I then went back to London and started trying to do street performing as well. And, you know, all of my fetish friends and all cabaret and all the rest of it were just going, what the fuck are you, why are you doing that?
Before you were street performing, did you know, like, the pull and all the various, like, moments you have to hit in order to get paid? Or was it just like, all right, I'm going on the street, we're doing this?
Yeah, not even to get paid. I mean, again, still didn't really understand theatre or... I didn't understand any of this stuff. So what my street show was me standing on a corner and then standing on a bin, it's a garbage bin, shouting at tourists for about 10, 15 minutes until I couldn't get away with it anymore. Then I'd jump off and swallow the sword. And somewhere in that, I would say to them, you know, like 10 minutes in, so who speaks English? And very few of them. So they're essentially watching an angry punk shout for 10 minutes, jump down and swallow a sword. And I tried quite a lot of elaborate setups that never worked. You know, I think quite a lot of people approach the street like that, but it just never worked. And the money was not the goal for me. For some reason, I've never been money centered, but I've wanted things to work and I wanted them to be good and integrity laden. But so I eventually ended up, after much, much failing, I mean, Jesus, I never managed to make the big pitch in Covent Garden work. I only ever died on my ass there. I ended up with a sack escape that Petra Massey from Spy Monkey gave me. Petra is the funniest woman I've ever met, I think. You know, she's phenomenal. And they're a good British example, I think, of the Goulier effect or the Lecoq effect. Because as you can see it, can't you? It's trends in some ways. And so,
would you describe what that effect is for listeners, or what sort of that style is?
It's a certain style of off clown, I would say. So there's, you know, at its base, it's about being present and being in the moment that's happening, be it a good or a bad one. The reality, though, I think, is that there is now an awful lot of clown that is tedious to watch. And what's much better is when people take the principles and apply it to now. So Spy Monkey, for example, are four very different people coming together and putting a premise on top and then applying the bits where my status plays well with your status here, or I can fuck you up here. And there's lots of games within it, but if you removed all the clowning, it's still a good show.
Yeah.
No, it's not, but you know what I mean? It's less.
It's got structure. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people mistake or get confused and don't quite understand that it takes a lot of, well, it's the same as in some ways that I'm doing. It takes a lot of organization to make chaos, mm-hmm. and it takes a lot of structure to seem unstructured. Mm-hmm. And I think people get confused by that, especially as disciplines kind of bleed into each other. So I think the comedy world has really grabbed, in the last 5 years, has really grabbed hold of that clowning style. Mm-hmm. To some great effect, but usually the great effect is the clowns infiltrating. What tends not to work is when a comic thinks they understand it and screws it up.
One of the things that we've noticed is like with comedy, it's almost like if you're afraid to fail, then you're just like even worse at, you know, it's just like you're working against yourself.
Yeah.
It seems like you failed a lot doing street shows. So that was probably like such a good builder for your skin of like not.
But again, I think the real builder for me was the flyering, because I flyered during quite so from 13 to 18, 19. So it's quite a formative period of your life. Anyway, you are worse than, I mean, you're on a par with beggars more than the busker is in some ways, because it's just
there's
shorter
skill you're offering. Yeah.
And it's a shorter interaction. They're required to walk past a beggar. They're required to walk past a flyer. You know, if it's a street performer, I don't have to. That's just an optional thing now. I don't have to stare at that poster. And so I, being relatively misanthropic, I got to a certain point where I was like, I'm just going to see who I'm a girl. I look enough like a girl, albeit a punky girl. I'm just going to see if I can get someone to punch me. So, I mean, I would be horrific to people just to see. And you'd never, you know, people wouldn't. But I think I really framed how it doesn't matter what comes at you, you can chat back. And I think actually what Street did was give me a really, really healthy understanding of humility and a massive respect for the seeming art of doing nothing. Mm-hmm. I still have that. I mean, and I have this with stand-ups as well, where it's like, if I walk on stage, in theory, I should be able to entertain for a long time or for plenty of time. But if I don't have a box of stuff with me or an iPad of thing with me, I feel lost. It throws me off. So I can go on sometimes and have those two things and not use them. But if they're not there, I will guaranteed die.
So what was the transition between doing street shows and going back to sort of a more formal staged kind of work?
Well, it kind of, there wasn't. I mean, I ran away from London for a bit and did a theatre course in Northern California in Del Arte because I wanted to...
Oh, that's all about status and like sort of personage.
And quite a few streeties have gone there. So Jonathan Taylor from Daredevil's gone there.
Oh, he's Tamara, great.
Yeah, I love him.
Yeah, Tamara Campbell, Shirley Slumflower have gone there. So I just thought, I need a change and this feels right. So I went off and did that. And what actually I found was there's a lot I have learned through the streeties, the good clowny streeties, and it was putting vocabulary to concepts as I walk away from it. So, but it was great to do. And I then carried on doing street, but I was doing street in Canada and Australia at that point. And in Australia, a couple of years before that, I had met the Spiegel Tent, the famous Spiegel Tent in Adelaide in 2000 at the Fringe. And it was the most magical, heavenly venue still to date. Nobody has replicated it. It was the most amazing crew. Every single one of their crew, from lights to front house, were so overqualified for the gig. It was insane. They were shit hot at what they did. They were shit hot at what they were currently doing. They looked sharp as all hell in very Melbourne outfit, but like trilby and suits. This tent was magical. It really was an old Spiegel tent. So you could feel the history in it. And they just, it was just a good time place. And David Bates, the guy whose tent it was, he got it because he's a jazz pianist who'd been traveling around the world, had a relationship with Scotland, was in Scotland, got wind of the fact that a brewery had bought this tent and wanted to offload it on the cheap because they couldn't do anything with it, somehow managed to get enough people together to buy it, bought it, and then basically traveled it between Melbourne, Adelaide, and Edinburgh. Wow. And it really was just this incredibly... He was a jazz pianist, you know, like, clearly not a businessman. But and so it was just, it was a genuinely, genuinely magical thing. And I got wind that they, because what they did is they do spot entertainment in the tents during the night over the course of the club. And the club's tracks were the best party music ever. So you're not techno, not swing, but some techno and some swing. Not all soul, but some, you know, it was just perfect. And then we'd pop up and do little spots. And so I got wind that they were putting together a show for, late night show for Edinburgh. And I basically said to Brett Haylock, who was putting it together, I said, I want in. I don't care how. I'm going to be up in Edinburgh Street performing anyway. Let's do it. And I persuaded him, went up to Edinburgh. I'd gone to the draw that day. It was a really, really rainy day. A few of the other people that worked in the tent were also street performers. And a few of the cast were. That's quite funny. The review we got, which absolutely slated street performers with no in one of the biggest newspapers in Edinburgh, with no awareness that three of the performers were street performers, who they would have. So it was like, what was the? We can all remember the quote. Hang on. If the street performers on the Royal Mile spent 30 years learning this, they might be good enough to sweep up backstage of this show. And you're talking. Three of the nine people in that show were street performers who you would have walked past on the Royal Mile that month, you know.
So, man.
It was a really rainy afternoon. So I fucked my show off and we're all sitting there trying to put it together. And at that point I realized it's probably going to make more sense if we divide me up. So I have, you know, here's my cabaret set as is, but why don't we chop that into three or four? And so I ended up doing that. One of the guys who brought the German contingent, he'd seen my street show, so he made me put my blow a glove up on your head routine in.
So what is that?
Fucking rubber outfit, swallow. Oh my God. Anyway, and so then that, and it went crazy from day one. We knew it was special. I mean, of course,
what was it called at the time, the show?
Le Clique. Yeah, and it was
backing
special
up for one second. What was the rubber on your head?
Oh, you know those surgical gloves?
Yeah.
It's quite a standard routine on the street. The works are cheap, but you blow it up on your head. Yeah,
Didn't know that was the technical term for it.
I call it the chicken. but we knew it was special from the first show. And it was interesting because it was, so the tent was magic, the operation was magic, all of the crew were magic, and then we were good acts. And the link, which I think nobody really saw, and in some ways I think most producers are still hunting for the next Le Clique, unaware that that was a point in time. Can't hunt for a point in time. It will just look dated. But anyway, back to them later. But the link between all of us, unintentionally, was sexuality. So there were two, there was identical blonde Polish twins who did quite an incestuous number in a bowl of water. Now, that's incestuous sex. Then you had David O'Meara doing his bath routine. That's just hot hetero sex. Martinez taking her, doing her hanky routine where she takes all her clothes off and pulls the hanky out of her. That's just hot, strong woman, powerful empowerment sex. You had the singer Camille O'Sullivan, who was like Irish and French. She was just like, oh God, Jesus kind of sex. You had the most beautiful, you know, Bond girl, beautiful hula hoop girl from Ukraine. That was just unreachable sex. And then I guess I was in rubber. So I was kind of like a
fetishized.
Weird. Yeah. And also with the sort of nature of stuff I was doing. But I think that Le Clique is where I'm. Le Clique and the cabaret stuff I was doing before then was when I realized I'm bored of the reaction, the sideshow reaction. I really enjoyed the sideshow while I was in the freak, and while I was moving through that period. I'm really interested in the history of entertainment. So I'd already, by the time I was doing that, I was already more interested in vaudeville historically, you know, so reading through all the stuff. And then by the time I was doing that, I was really interested in lounge. So I got, I mean, and in some ways that's where I stopped, where I'm just like Dean Martin and Jack Benny. That's all I need. Everything is there. But so playing with, particularly in Le Clique, it was that thing of going, well, I don't want the reaction to be, you know, there needs to be more nuance than that. You need to shock them, yes, but they need to just be loving the character. And it started with the street because you have to be able to play from 8 to 80. You have to be able to play a split level of a crowd. God, I'm just chatting now.
Great. This is what we love. So were you part of Le Clique when it came to New York and when it sort of traveled the world?
Yeah. Although, of course, when it came to New York, we were absent, weren't we?
Yes, rebranded.
And we had a ball. I mean, there are definitely stories I won't be saying on this podcast, but it's safe to say we had done 6 weeks in Montreal, and then we had one day travel, got to New York, had a day and a half set up, and then we opened for 2 months there. And let me tell you, that was a party time. But, you know, it was good. It was amazing, actually. And I loved that season, and I loved New York. And in some ways, I don't know, it would have been fun. Would have been fun to see what happens if that relationship could have carried on.
Mm.
But let's tell everyone what Misbehaved Game Show is.
Oh, yeah. Maybe you can. Well, should we start with what it is or how it or how came it, into existence?
How, let's do how it came into existence.
All right. So Misbehaved Game Show came together because I got meningitis. So basically, I got sick of doing slick variety. I started producing my own variety shows, which had far more of a comedy bent, which allowed me to bring in a lot more of the streeties I know can really run indoors. And I brought back, it was called The Crack. And I'd had people like Dr. Stewart. I had Hot Nuts and Popcorn. I had Peter Post. I had some of the best street performers going. And also some brilliant comedy variety acts. I was still working on the idea of high end. And then I was doing a fair bit of that. And then I wanted to put together something the complete opposite of that. So I bought an army mess tent. I arranged this fucking sweet deal with a bunch of things in Edinburgh and basically was going to take up this army mess tent and run sideshow, but Edinburgh style. So no Australians shouting for 45 minutes, literally the way you sell sideshow in Edinburgh. And the stuff I wanted to put in it was the barking would be, fuck off, we don't want you. Nah, you're not coming in. Don't like the look of you. You wouldn't like this. Not for you. Go and see one of those shows. 10 days before that, I was doing Edmonton Street Festival and there was an outbreak of adult mumps and I hadn't had it. And I ended up getting meningitis, viral meningitis. 10 days before, I'd been working on this project for a fucking year. And so I, for better or worse, I sent it up to Edinburgh with friends to run it. And that was the start of me actually engaging with wanting to make what I call, I suppose shorthand would be renegade entertainment, where it's the whole premise was read the room. So I had a large show planned as well, which was I was going to utilize every contact I had, pull them on stage, famous or not, pull them on stage. And if they weren't reading the room, kick them out. Literally, just fucking you're off stage. Back to like the Apollo, you know, live at the Apollo when they used to have the doctor dancing on, hooking them off and all that, you know, vaudeville, you know, the carpet, the flowers, the band, lots of stuff. But I had meningitis, couldn't. So then for 2 years, I couldn't do anything. The post-viral, it was horrible. I'd lost, kind of lost everything, didn't know what the hell I was doing. Then I managed to claw my way back in, and Soiree gave me a bunch of work. And so I was off to do an Australian tour at Sydney Opera House and everything. And then Vegas called. And I got the offer of hosting a late night show on the Strip with Cal McChrystal, who is kind of the guy that has brought Lecoq to the English speaking world in a way through Spy Monkey, directed most of Spy Monkey's shows. Directed a lot of funnies. In fact, directed a lot of the clowns in Cirque as well. So he was going to be directing it. And a comic called Scott Capurro, who is a very funny American blue as all shit shock comic, was going to write it. And I'm going to be hosting a late night cabaret on the Strip. I'm like, brilliant. This is too good to be true. Cancelled all my work. And it was too good to be true. The gig fell through. So I've now got nothing. I haven't worked for 2 years as well. And I think, fuck. So I get in touch with a friend who runs a sideshow tent in Adelaide in Australia, Louise Clark and Nigel Martin, who got Mr. Spin, and said, can I come and do sideshow in your tent? Don't know what I'm going to do yet. I said, sure. Got myself over there and then had, so 15-minute show for $5. Essentially, you're barking them in and you're playing to drunks. Which is great. You know, that's like, I understand that. I love it. My initial intention was to put together a motivational speaking show for punks, because I figured, like, actually the over 40 market who are not, not traditional, they're not really being served at the moment. You know what I mean? Like, where's all their shit? They didn't die. They're kind of not as punky as they used to be, but still they're a bit anti this and blah, blah, blah. And I did one night of that. It's about 4 shows. Hated it. And then was staying with my friend Stompy, who is one of my comic heroes as well. He's just wonderful. He does dot comedy and very funny man. So we're there and I'm like, right, before we go to bed, we've got to figure this out. So we ended up drinking and came up with the idea of a game show. And then I went to bed and I woke up the next day and kind of just chilled out and really, you know, wasn't bothered because it is sideshow as well. You can kind of think on the fly. I'd already had the gold costume made. I knew I wanted that gold costume, and I knew I wanted to dance. So what I had been doing was outside was just iPod dancing through a speaker. So I'd literally have, you know, and I was just like a glitter ball just dancing in the middle of the field. Couldn't give a fuck. I remember Scott Maidment coming over to me just going, I just don't understand why you're getting a crowd doing that. Like, and I said, Scott, therein lies the issue, isn't it? Yeah. But so then I knew I was doing a game show, but about an hour and a half before the show, I didn't know what any of that game show was going to be because I'd been super casual and I was really hungover. And then I've been banging on for years about the fact that people don't use the hypocrisy of live entertainment and cell phones. It really annoys me, and it has annoyed me for a long time. We work in short form, non-fourth wall entertainment. I mean, how horrible does that sound? But that's the basis of what we do. So we have to. Like, stand-up wasn't doing it. Variety wasn't doing it. Cabaret wasn't doing it. You're like, the hypocrisy of the fact that you tell people not to, and then you leave after your 5 minutes, and you go on the phone. So we've changed. We are changing. How we are is changing. So I thought, right, I can actually use phones for this. Decided to divide them with phones. Came up with 4 or 5 silly games. Thought, I know, I can have them throw rubbish at me while I dance. That'll be the grand prize. And started there. And the first show I did, I went, this is something. This is, like, literally, it was all over the place. And again, it was a 15-minute sideshow with just me. But after a month of that, I knew it was something, and my kind of ethos was coming out, you know, the sort of, in some ways, the motivational speaking for punks, you know, life's shit, what's wrong with that? And then I went back to London after that, and I'd booked in to do a couple of big variety shows at the Wonderground, which is a sort of 600-capacity Spiegel tent. and I booked my style of acts. But I thought, instead of doing what I usually do, why don't I plonk that stuff on top of it? And so I basically went out and did an epic rant for, you know, played a few games, but epic rant for about 20 minutes and then brought on a bunch of great acts. And I went, yeah, okay. And I, what do I call that? Misbehave's Pleasure Aid and Social Club.
How'd you come up with Misbehave as like your character name?
I'd been working, when I was at the freak show, I had been trash because I'd been found in a side, you know, in a dumpster and I ate everything. That was the sideshow name. Before that, I'd been the proverbial Amy because I thought that was really natty. And then, like, okay, I need an actual stage name. And so I was in a bar in London brainstorming with friends. And there's a very dry British comedy called Rising Damp. And one of the characters in there is Mrs. Jones. And she's just fabulous. She's just like an old lush. I loved her. And so my favorite name was Mrs. Jones. I wanted to be Mrs. Jones. But we were talking it through and we was like, come on, it makes more sense to have a naff gag in here. So we worked through all of them. And the one I really wanted was Misanthropy. But I realized that the only way that the people that did understand what that meant would hate me because I called myself that. And most people wouldn't understand what it meant. So it'd be like, what the fuck is she calling herself that? So that went. And ended up with Misbehave, kind of trial and error and drinking. And the first time I was going to be Misbehave, it was playing the RVT, playing a club called Ducky, which is a long-running queer club. It's brilliant. And the guy that runs it, I saw the listing and it was Amy the Sword Swallower. So I called him up and said, oi, I'm Misbehave. Why have you put me down as that? And he went, oh, darling, it's just so 80s drag queen New York. Of which is not wrong.
No, not totally off base. That's amazing.
That's where that ended up. And then, but so I did a couple of these, big shows in London and I just went, okay, this is working for me. This is the direction I'm going. I don't know what else I'm doing. But at that point, it was also the idea that it was a variety show. And then I went up to Edinburgh. I think that's the way that went up to Edinburgh. Oh God. Yeah, that's right. This is 2 years on from meningitis. I had, with a guy called Bob Slayer, I knew I wanted to do my show at the Free Fringe, not the Fringe Fringe. I got in touch with him and said, can I, cause he'd been running a Free Fringe venue. And he said, well, this might be interesting to you. Someone's offered me a shop, an empty shop. And I went, scratch everything. I want to do that. He's like, I'm not sure about running this. I don't know how to do it. I'm like, I got this. I'm going to program this for you. And this is my jam. I want to do this. So I got my friend Stompy to come to do Let's Figure It Out When You Get There, because he's so funny. And I persuaded Adrienne Triscott to come and break her Asking for a Cherry there. I was like, this is perfect for you. This is perfect. This is what's going to happen. You're going to go there. You're going to kill and you're going to win an award. And I was right. Anyway, 10 days before that, I was doing a street festival in Ireland, Dublin, and I was doing a handstand on two guys and I came down, had a bad landing and broke my heel.
Ah.
Literally almost to the day I'd got meningitis. I was like, you are fucking joking. I go up to Edinburgh anyway, realize after two painful days that there's no way I can do this run. And so go back down to London, aware again that this beautiful thing I'd started, I didn't get to properly birth. It killed me. This is running the venue as well, like just having that whole exciting people you've brought in and all the rest of it. Foot healed. I met up with a kid I'd given a spot to in a show in Blackpool I'd done, where I was helping run a festival. And we were getting on well. This was Harry. And I had him because my foot was, I'd had some gigs booked in September in London, and my foot was just about better, but I couldn't wear heels. So we decided, why don't you be my assistant? Because I need help. And that, at this point, the first run I'd had my hula hoop girl, Kalki, actually has worked the New York circuit a lot as well. Kalki Hula Girl, she does a routine where she's a drunken slag, basically. She's got toilet paper up her ass and throws up into her handbag while doing brilliant hula hooping. And she was 6 months pregnant at the time. So she was my assistant and she was also did that act, and she was also 6 months pregnant. Brilliant. But had Harry be my assistant, and it was my functional assistant because of the foot, and we got on well. So I thought, okay, I want to take this up to Edinburgh next year, and I want to put it into a pop-up venue. I want to do what I should have been able to do this year. So we went and did that, and Harry came up, and we actually played really well together, and my show also developed, and I put in lots of new stuff, and I got the month of running in a new, you know, a new idea properly. And then I just started doing it wherever and whenever I could. So it was basically me then taking it, whether it's a, you know, a two-hander hour job or a two-hour, three variety acts in it as well, jobby.
Or the 1 hour and 15 minutes version in New York.
Exactly, even though it's only supposed to be an hour. It felt much better to be hustling something that felt fresh.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose I was the go-to host and variety show putter together at that point, on the lower echelons, you know, not buying five houses, but actually, oh, she's the go-to girl, but there's lots more people coming up. And also it didn't feel so engaging to me. It's something that's fun to do, but like it's done. So this felt good. And I sold that around the world too. So I went to Adelaide Fringe. I went to some random festival in Hong Kong, went to the Amsterdam Fringe. Did some international festivals at Adelaide Cabaret Festival. This is where the timelines get all fucked up. I decided to do Edinburgh for a second year and do it as a marketing thing, because with Edinburgh, I find it's a split level. You can run in an idea, as people like us, you can run in an idea, or you can have a marketing festival to raise your profile. I was like, it's time to raise the profile with it. It's a good product. It's cheap. This should be easy to sell. I went into Assembly. I did a big... that's sort of a 200, 300 capacity venue that was perfect. Got great reviews, great responses, and worked my ass off in the upper bits as well, because again, it was me doing everything. And I didn't get any bites. Like, I wanted to get a producer from the end of that, or at least a presenter or promoter, something. No bites. And so it was still then me hustling. And by this point, I'm tired. So it was trying to figure out what's the next step. And so I'd sort of begun the whole, here we go with Australia again. And then I got a call from a guy called Paul Nathan. I'm not sure if you know Paul. He's a magician based in San Francisco. Real hustler, carny as fuck, and belligerent and obstinate as all hell. So we get on great, because we're just basically rude to each other at speed. Now, it comes from love, you know? And Paul's great. Paul has done some good carny hustling. He's got an excellent show called the I Hate Children's Children Show. Now sort of tours around the world doing very well, because he's clever like that. And he got hold of a lease on a theater in San Francisco called The Great Star. So it's like in Chinatown, it holds 450, much too big for it. But anyway, he called me up and he said, do you want to come and do my theater? And it clashed with Perth Fringe. And I just went, if I don't have to pay anything, yeah. Because actually what's Perth Fringe, you know, I'd done the numbers and it's like, even if we did really well, it's just change. Like small change to spend 10 days with friends in the heat.
Yeah.
Like San Francisco sounds like more fun. Go to San Francisco, have a ball, don't sell out, but absolutely get, you know, swept up in love with the wonderful community that's there. Really had a ball and persuaded Julie Richardson, who persuaded David Foster. So she brought Foster down and they came and saw the show. And then I pitched them like a motherfucker afterwards and basically decided to let's do it. Now, the it then takes forever. And also, and I've spoken to so many performers who do have producers, I think it's very reasonable. Unless you're under their you know, nose, then it becomes almost, so we were having like a weekly Skype call with no movement. So I still had a work visa. And so John and Anne, I could finally go and play in their lovely La Tigre tent. We've been wanting to do it for years, but I'm too scared to work in the US without a work visa. So we'd never been able to do it. And then it was like, oh, we can finally do it. So I went over to the States last October. We did some Tigre dates and then we passed through Vegas. So I was like, great, I can get under their skin now and really light a fire. Because what I wanted to do was I wanted us to do a showcase at Joe's Pub. And I thought with their connections, with my connections, that should be doable. And now, I mean, again, David Foster, who knows? But nothing was happening. So I get to Vegas, have some meetings with them, try and light a fire under their ass. Know I'm going to be in Vegas for a little bit anyway. And I just went, all right, here's what I'm going to do. And I called, did a few calls in New York and got the Pit, which I love the Pit. They're just great. They're the only working model in New York or anywhere. They have fucking 12 shows a night.
Yeah. Then, I know, it's crazy. It's really, their backbone is the improv scene. And yeah, the improv scene in New York and LA and Chicago is super strong. So that can carry them.
Even so, I just think it's wonderful the way they run it as well, like 50-50. So it's a wonderful model for artists. So I went in there to just do a one-nighter, my goal purely being to get the lady from Ghost Pub to come and see it.
Josh Abner.
And Josh Abner. I found out afterwards. And I didn't have my glamorous assistant, so I borrowed a lovely queen from New York called Glace Chase, who was a delight and also was a great educator for me of going, that's a lot to throw something at someone, by the way. Just so you know, afterwards, that's a lot to throw at someone. I'm like, good to know, good to know. And the result of that was she did come, and that was great, and it was potential I could have pushed that. But what the actual result was, I then flew back to Vegas and realized I had lit a fire under their ass. So by the time I was leaving, they was talking about, let's do a showcase here. And I'm like, yes, let's. You know, so then I get back to the UK, and this showcase comes together. So we then pop over to Vegas for 3 days in December, do a showcase for the great and good and the wonderful community here. And it went off. And I think the reason it actually got as far as it did was all the next step was the fact that the head of Caesars came in and went, this is the future of entertainment. I want this. And I think that's what probably gave Foster the impetus. That said, it still took another 6-7 months to come through. And then there's, you know, everything from what does Trump's America do to a work visa? How do you know, like just the different things.
The drama was in the last year. Yeah.
Yeah. And then also just the job of raising enough money to at least open, et cetera. And within that time, my other glamorous assistant, Harry, he left and joined Briefs, which is a wonderful all boys variety show. And Brett Pfister, who I'd known for a long time.
And previous podcast guest for those who are listening.
I met Brett in Montreal during that party season when he was like 19. His act blew me away. We then met back. We saw each other a few times that way, but bumped into each other when I was living in Berlin. And I was casting. Well, I was putting together a big variety show for London. And his circus had just collapsed, literally. So we were like, fuck it, let's go get drunk. So we went, and there's a lot of that theme. I don't drink that much anymore. went to the Winter Garden, got so blind drunk on white wine, I don't think either of us have ever drunk it since. Forced the poor audiences of that awful show, forced the poor performers, rather, to do 7 curtain calls, just because we know how Germany works. Evil. And then I said, why don't you come and do the show in London? And at that point, he'd been using a really obscure new romantic track, 80s track. And I'm like, can we make the track? Can we do, your act is amazing. I hate Ariel and I love your act, right? You're phenomenal. Can we make that track more likable? And so we sort of came up with a bunch of music. I'm like, great, pick from that. And then he came and played London, ended up moving to London. And we played in soiree a lot, but it was, I had no idea that he was up for this. As soon as I found out he was, it was just after the Vegas thing, the showcase, he said, have you ever thought about having 2 glamorous assistants, 1 for Android and 1 for iPhone? I'm like, that's a great idea. And he's like, can I be the Android? I'm like, yes, you can. And then Harry went and joined Briefs. I'm like, do you want to be both? And what I love about Brett is he's the only circus performer I've ever met whose dream is to be a sitcom writer. And I find him insanely funny on and off. It's very fortunate that he's another virtuoso. It's interesting, the ones that are really virtuistic, he's one of them. And it's great that that's the muscle he wants to exercise, because we're having a ball.
It was just a matter of time before he was just doing comedy as the thing.
And so it was quite serendipitous how the sequence of events worked out, but it's good. I'm having a ball with him over here. We've got 2 new bits I'm going to put in the show, but, you know.
All right, so now is the pitch part to the audience. Can you explain maybe like a handful of games or just 1 or 2 games to give a sense of like what are these challenges that we've been talking about?
So I guess the game show is essentially a split audience of iPhones and everybody else, but you can cheat. I've always been very interested in chaos and or the really renegade, you know, anything from Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis's original act through to alternative comedy when it would get really wild through to Bear Pit, you know, legendary points in the stand-up scene where it was more about the hecklers through to a guy called Malcolm Hardy, who was kind of an absolute renegade virtuoso in the UK on the alt comedy scene. He ran a club called The Tunnel where the hecklers were the stars. If you made it 15 seconds, you were lucky. Also through to the amateur night at the Apollo when I used to watch it at 4 a.m. on Channel 4, just with the, it was very little to do with the acts. It was to do with what the audience wanted. And I really felt, so I like being able to get the audience, not necessarily a part of it, but just riled up. And I hate audience participation. So this is a very long-winded pitch, apologies. But so I hate audience participation, but you need an engaged and interactive audience if you're going to ask them questions and get, play games with them. So I realized, well, that's fine. You can do what you want. So you can sit there and do nothing. You can spend the whole time on your phone, or you can jump up and strip off naked, whatever works for you, you know, and anything in between. And I unintentionally, and I think this is probably Steiner, most of the games are either like playing Snap with someone or being chased up the stairs. That same like feeling where it's like, it's like, and that's not considered or thought or anything like that. So a lot of the games are literally people just shouting shit. So one of the games is shout loudest. And, you know, whichever side shouts loudest might win, because actually the thing with that is who wants it more. And so it's me, it's again, serendipitously have come up with a load of really silly games, but also over top of it is it's your life. If you don't do anything with your, you know, nothing's going to come to you unless you grab it. It's rarely the person that deserves anything that gets it. It's usually just the fucker that wants it the most. And everything's shit, so let's have fun with that. I mean, and then I guess for a podcast, so the and the tight bit on that, the explanation at the top of the show is sort of says everything for me, which is, you know, everything great, everything brilliant, is it? Really? Because I think everything's fucked. So let's have fun with that. Because I really do genuinely feel this is like, let's just dance on the debris of humanity. Because guys, we are in the debris stage.
We can cut this out if you're like, I want to keep all the scenes for the show. But maybe just as a good example is the life lottery.
Yes.
Game is sort of a sense of like the comedy and also the participation and also like the subtext. So maybe you can explain that game as well.
Sure. So we have, I have a bunch of lotteries I do in the game show. One of them is the laid lottery. So you just get everybody to stand up, and then if you've been laid in the last 24 hours, you sit down and you work through, and we find out which side or which person has not been laid in the longest, and they get a pity point, which is kind of one of the fun games in the show. But I guess a good game to explain the sort of vibe is that the life lottery. So you get everybody to stand up again. You ask them a series of questions, and through those questions, we find out who the poorest person in the room is. Then we repeat it, but find out who the richest person in the room is. And at that point, you get those two people to stand up. The poorest person gets $5, and the richest person gets $50. And then you just wait. And the room lets everybody know what the fair way to do. I mean, and it's just a really interesting, because there is a sort of interesting thing where similarly, when people shout out things they want, because you can cheat, because one of the terms and conditions of the show is don't ask, don't get. So if somebody asks for 50 points, completely reasonable. But let's see what the room says. And the room goes, no. Room says you can have 2 points. Fair enough. You know, so it's really interesting experiment. And I do find it quite an anthropological experiment when you get a bunch of people, small enough amount of people, anything from sort of 200 to 600, they can let you know what's fair. They can let each other know what's fair and what's right. What's annoying? What's shut the fuck up? You know, you think you're being funny. You're not. You're really annoying the rest of the room. You know, early on, actually, I did one show and I was having a load of fun with this dude down the front. He was jumping up and he was just engaged all the time, all the time, all the time. And then in the interval, I looked at the show phone and I realized I was the only person who was enjoying him, because the rest of them was like, his name was Gary. Tell Gary to shut the fuck up. Tell Gary to sit down. Gary's really annoying us. So when we came back, we start the second half and Gary starts going again. And I say, do you know, Gary, you're actually annoying quite a lot of the room. And there was an absolute roar. And within that roar, Gary understood and chilled out to the level he needed to. Not knocked down and go small, but just understood, oh, I've taken up too much attention. People are getting bored with that. I can roll with this. And it's fascinating how people are when they are free to do whatever they want. And I think the reason people get so competitive is because of the smartphones. But I think the reason people do so much is because they don't have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the reverse psychology. It's like, you don't have to do anything. Yeah. No, I am.
I'm going to do something.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I think we're nearing that point in the podcast where we ask our three final questions that are the same for everybody. Mm-hmm. The first being, has there been a piece of advice you've gotten from somebody that's really good or really bad that has stuck with you?
Well, one of the strongest lessons I got was from that dwarf in the Freak Show where he said, you know, you have to get the skewers to the Prince of Pain so he can pierce his face, but the journey, that's yours. And I think the reason that that lesson stuck with me is because it took me six years to understand what he meant. And that was very freeing.
So the second question is, and I think you've mentioned a few books and references, but it's more for people who are listening and are students. Is there a book or a movie or a TV show or just an artistic reference that you would recommend somebody see?
Yes. There is a book called written by a New Yorker who is illegally young to have written such a brilliant book. I've read it twice. I've recommended it to lots of people. And it's called No Applause, Just Throw Money.
He was our guest two podcasts ago.
Right, Travesty.
Yeah.
I like historical stuff, but I find it really hard. It's always so dry. And this book was the most informative book I've read about vaudeville, as well as being a really good read. It blew my mind when I found out that he'd wrote it at the age of 32. You know, so I've never met him. I've written to him and said, love your work and all the rest of it. That book is a really good read.
Well, when you come to New York, we'll do an intro. He's a really smart, nice guy.
Cool. I mean, yeah. So that blew me away. There's a book, and it's convoluted what it's called. But so what's great about that book is it gives you a real overview via the people, but via how the industry worked. Never mind the fucking act. And then there's another book called, it's something about the history of pantomime, told through Joseph Grimaldi, and it's a British book, and it is the history of pantomime, and it gives you also the history of how many times the theatres burnt down when the Covent Garden Opera House came up, what the fact there wasn't opera in there, the fact that that burnt down three times, and also runs through Grimaldi's great-grandfather, and himself.
And for those who don't know, Grimaldi is sort of like the clown prior to clowns, almost doing the very heavy makeup and doing sort of the more old, what we consider old school, but at the time was very contemporary style of clowning.
Yes, because so he's credited with creating the Joey, essentially. So prior to that, the clowns within the spheres were kind of harlequins. So they were ethereal beings. They weren't necessarily funny, and he grounded it. And from there, slowly the conventions of pantomime were born. As you know, I mean, commedia had been going for sort of 300 years by this point, but just the more topical and more confined, less strolling players side of that and real archetypes of characters came through. So this book is a really, again, nice way it's being told through architecture and through Grimaldi. And in between, you also understand how so many of the conventions we use without thinking about it and so many of the status play we use without thinking about it, how they were actually born. It's a fucking great read.
Nice. All right, I'm definitely Googling that after this.
I'm reading Carol Burnett's book right now, which is really good because she was so influenced by vaudeville and how she structured her show. It's interesting. If you're looking for a book to read in your free time.
What's the title of her book?
It's the newest one. I don't remember the title. It's really long. It's like Carol Burnett, 11 years, blah, 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 because, you know, her show ran for 11 years. And it's like a white cover. I don't know. It's the newest one, but it's really good.
She's got Phyllis Diller's got the best title for a autobiography ever, which is like a lampshade in a whorehouse. That's quite a good read.
Yeah, see, if you can't remember the title, it's probably not a very good title.
Right.
But last question. Who do you think we should have on the show next?
Have you had RJ? I'm thinking, God, my friend Stompy would be excellent. Mookie Cornish would be good.
Mookie would be great.
I love her.
Petra and or Toby from Spy Monkey would be great.
Yeah.
Actually, as would Itor, who passes through New York a bit more than they do, I think. You just have to deal with his annoying accent, but that's Itor. Just don't ask him to get his cock out. It's the smallest cock in the world. It's like an acorn in the forest. Oh, and my friend Dr. Stewart. It would take a minute, but he'd be amazing. He's an old street performer who was in the Fifth Dimension, the Fifth Element, who is the reason that Sacha Baron Cohen exists. And basically, if you look at most amazing things, they trace back to Dr. Stewart, and he has zero credit for all of it. But he's a wonderful guy, and he's not bitter about it. That's an unsatisfactory answer from me.
No, those are great.
That's like 10 answers.
Yeah, that's a lot of material. We got plenty of people to interview and books to read and things to Google. Amy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and chatting with us. It was really fun. I'm excited for people to hear this.
Yes, thank you. And go buy your tickets to see Misbehave Game Show.
Yay.
At Bally's. It's amazing. Guys. And that was our interview with Amy Saunders.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please like us on Facebook, Twitter, tweet us, follow us on iTunes, and give us a positive rating. You can also check out our website, howtoacircus.com, and subscribe to our mailing list.
Have a great week.
Bye.